Any questions from discussion group that anyone would like to bring up before we move on to this afternoon's topics?
Yeah. The first question of our discussion questions sent us into a conversation about is Buddhism a religion or not? and we boiled that down to actually probably something that's a simpler question, which is, what does the prostration or the vow signify? Is that does it signify a sort of worshiping or a respect or something in between? Or?
First off, is Buddhism a religion? To answer that, you would have to define the word religion. And I read recently a modern-day philosopher who studied this a little bit and basically came to the conclusion that in our modern-day world, there are at least four major different ideas about what the word religion means. And I don't have them anymore, but I remember at the time I looked at the four main definitions of the word, and according to two of them, Buddhism was a religion, and according to two, it was not. I think one of those four was the idea that a religion is a belief in some sort of creator god. If that's the case, then Buddhism's not. But I think one of them was more about, is there something beyond the material, mundane world? Is there some higher purpose to life or something? And of course there, yes. And the other two I can't remember, but there were some variations of those. And then the second part was about... prostration, the actual physical prostration, a number of purposes. One of them is to, as an antidote to what's called pride. And pride here in Buddhism is not feeling good about ourselves. The word pride is often called afflicted pride. It's this sort of arrogant, puffed up mind thinking we're special, we're superior. And so the fact of physically going down is really like subduing that arrogant attitude. And actually there's a very nice little quote that I like that's related to that, which says that the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. So the analogy is that the mountain peaks are like pride, and the low, fertile valleys is where the harvest grows best. And, of course, that is humility. So that's a nice analogy that I like. And so the physical act of prostrating is to... One purpose is to subdue this arrogant mind thinking we're someone special. But also, of course, it's to, as you said, to show respect. And so with this, we need to be careful. You know, of course, we can look at this as some sort of worship in terms of worshipping someone or something, in terms of doing that with the hope that they're going to do something for us. You know, please, Buddha, fix all of my problems. Please, Buddha, give me a lot of money, you know. This, in Buddhism, is very much discouraged, you know. because it's not the right perspective. It's just getting caught up in the eight worldly concerns again, you know. And it's not really going to lead us in any good direction. But is to show that sort of respect, as we're going to see here with the going for refuge, and also with respecting the teacher and so forth. So this is really the purpose of doing this, is to show that respect and faith that our teacher or the Dharma or something can really benefit us, rather than sort of this blind worship. And of course in Buddhism there's a lot of talk about faith, but we can talk about at least two types of faith. There's blind faith and then there's faith based on reasoning. And so what is very much emphasized in Buddhism is the latter, the faith based on reasoning. The blind faith is not really much use, that we need to investigate and see whether these teachings are going to benefit us. And if we can see there's something beneficial there, then we can have faith in these teachings based on reasoning, investigation. So this is what we're talking about. Then we can have respect and faith towards this, that this is going to bring us some benefit in our life.
About the discussion that we had yesterday on the concept of mind, and the, you know, the scientific evidence to support it. Basically, well, I brought up in discussion, and without going into too great a detail, about this study that Emory University did on mice and cherry blossoms, and how you should look. I mean, it sounds silly, but basically, what this study did is determine that somehow these traumatic events or these this fear conditioning is passed down in DNA and in these mice genes. I mean, would you say that that's a good evidence to back up this concept of mind? I guess it's, I mean, obviously it's a rat brain, but I mean,
well, I don't know the study you're referring to, and so I'd have to look at the study and what. But of course, a lot of these studies. Various studies, you know, sometimes you can draw different conclusions, you know, and sometimes the conclusions that are drawn are based on different assumptions. So, you know, often I see sometimes these scientific experiments being run, and then the person who's running it comes out with this bold claim that this proves this. And then often a few years later they've had to eat their words because it's shown that their assumptions were really not valid. So I think the bottom line is that yes, we can draw on these things, but we need to have a sort of healthy skepticism and not just, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so where are we? So we're looking in the Lam Rim again, this Lam Rim Chenmo from Lamatsong Kapa, and we've had a look at the first topic of how to rely on the teacher, and then on that basis, we then started to look at, well, how students can rely, or what are the stages of the students train having relied on a teacher. And the first topic then we looked at this morning there was reflecting on the precious human life, to really reflect on this precious opportunity we have, the fact that we have not just a human life, but we have a life, human life, with a lot of conducive conditions to be able to follow the spiritual path, to have a meaningful life. And so then the question is, of course, how can we take advantage of these opportunities that we have? How can we make our life meaningful? And then we looked earlier at on the bottom of page 6, the idea that we can take advantage of this precious human life at these three levels. That at the basic level, the minimum way we could make our life meaningful would be to strive for what's called high status, basically a good future life. And then on top of that, then we can strive for the next higher level of the goal of liberation from suffering altogether, the goal of nirvana. And then on that basis, we can strive for the further goal of enlightenment so that we can also help to liberate everyone else from samsara, from suffering. So therefore, we have these three levels of making our life meaningful, and they correspond to the person of small, medium, and great capacity. And so that's what we are now going to look at, is how we can make that life meaningful at those three levels. And so, of course, we're going to begin on page 7 here with the training for someone of small capacity. But actually, if we just briefly look at the overview of the outlines here, what we can see is within each of these three levels, small, medium, and great capacity, it's more or less divided into two parts. The first part is to first be able to develop the aspiration for that goal. So here, of course, someone of small capacity is aspiring to a good future. So the first outline here we see is titled Developing a State of Mind that Strives Diligently for the Sake of Future Lives. And then further down, the second outline says Relying on the Means for Achieving Happiness in the Next Life. So the two main sections here, first is how do we develop the aspiration to strive for that goal? And then once we've developed that aspiration, how do we achieve that goal? What are the practices? Similarly, we have in the medium and great capacity, we will have the first outline is in the medium capacity, how do we develop the aspiration for nirvana, this renunciation? And then in the second main outline, well, what are the practices then we need to engage in having developed that aspiration to achieve that goal? Likewise, in the great capacity, the first outline is how do we go about developing this aspiration for enlightenment, bodhicitta? And then once we've developed it, how do we actually strive for the goal of enlightenment? What are the practices there? We look at these six perfections. So that's what we have in each of these three levels. The first part, how do we develop the aspiration for the goal that we are striving for? Then following that, what are the practices that we need to engage in to actually strive for that goal? So here then, if we go back into the outlines, so the first part then is to how to develop the aspiration to strive for this high status or good future lives. And so here we have actually two outlines within it. The first one here is, it says, developing a state of mind that strives diligently for the sake of future lives. And within that, the first one is mindfulness of death. So the first reflection here, topic that's going to help us to be able to develop that aspiration to strive for a good future, is mindfulness of death. So let's have a look at this outline here and see what it is involved. So in that outline, the first part of the quote there says, although it is quite hard to produce this mindfulness of death, you must work at it because it is the foundation of the path. And what we're going to see there is that the reason it says it's the foundation of the path is that even though we may have reflected on our precious human life and really appreciated that we have this wonderful opportunity, then often we don't really do anything much about it because, you know, we feel as if we've got a lot of time and, you know, I'm sort of busy doing all my career stuff now and enjoying myself and, you know, I can sort of do that spiritual stuff maybe later. And so then we keep putting it off and we never really engage in anything. So here, mindfulness of death is going to help us to avoid that. So if we look at the next outline, it says the faults of not cultivating mindfulness of death. So again, here it says the avenue of injury is the very thought, I will not die. If you are obstructed by such an attitude and do not bring its remedy to mind, you will continue to think that you will remain in this life. Then you will continually think about how to achieve happiness and evade suffering in this life alone. So this is really talking a lot about these eight worldly concerns, thinking, I need this and that. You will not engage in religious practice because you will not think about things of great importance, such as future lives, liberation, and omniscience. You will create strong attachment to goods, services, and the like. As if swept away by a current of a river, you will be immersed in strong hostility towards what prevented you or what you fear might prevent you from having these objects of attachment. Then death will overcome you and bad karma will lead you into a hot, unpleasant place among strong and harsh sufferings of the miserable realms. What process could be worse than that? And then the next outline is talking about the opposites. Then if we cultivate, what are the benefits of cultivating the mindfulness of death? It says, if you create an authentic mindfulness of death, you will see that all toiling for worldly things such as goods, respect and fame is as fruitless as a winnowing chaff and is source of deception. You will then turn away from wrongdoing. With constant and respectful effort, you will accumulate good karma by doing such virtuous deeds as going for refuge and maintaining ethical discipline. You will ascend to a sublime state and will lead others there as well. What could be more meaningful? Therefore, the thought that you will not die is the source of all deterioration, and the remedy for this is mindfulness of death, the source of all that is excellent. And in this, there is a very nice quote, which I was going to quote later, but now I've had to try and find it. I can find it here somewhere in my notes. Yeah, here it is. It's a quote from Steve Jobs, and I think everyone knows who Steve Jobs was, the CEO of Apple, of course. And it was part of a speech he did a number of years ago to students at Stanford University. And so this is part of it, and he says the following. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, If you live each day as if it were your last, someday you'll most certainly be right. It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations or pride or fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. So I think what's being said here is that if we really don't reflect on death, then there's very much danger that we don't really see the precious opportunity we have. It's not going to last forever, and we're not going to prioritize our life and really do what is important and meaningful, and we're probably going to waste our life a lot. So let's have a look now here what is the mindfulness of death that we're trying to cultivate. It says the kind of mindfulness of death you should develop. It says you should fear death if you have not secured your welfare in future lives by putting an end to the causes of miserable realms and establishing the causes of high status and certain goodness. Thus, when you contemplate impermanence again and again, you think, I will undoubtedly separate from my body and resources soon, and you stop the craving that hopes not to leave them. Consequently, you will not fear death out of the distress of leaving. So here, then, we are to really reflect on death and not try and avoid it, or, you know, unfortunately in our modern society, death is a thing that's often not only not thought about but actively hidden. You know, we sort of sweep it under the carpet and we avoid it at all costs. But of course, all that does is it just makes death a very unknown, fearful thing that's sort of always in the back of our mind, and it's of no benefit, and it just creates a lot of fear and anxiety. Rather, if we really reflect on death, as Steve Jobs said, then we can really, you know, appreciate what life really is and how precious it is, and we'll really want to make the most of our life, make our life as meaningful as possible. So let's now have a look at how we can do that. And the standard way here that's mentioned in the Lam Rim of how to cultivate mindfulness of death is often what's called the 9-point death meditation, which we see here, the next outline, how to cultivate mindfulness of death. And within these 9 points, we have 3 main points. And within each of these main points, we have 3 things to think about. So let's have a look at those and see what they are. So the first point here is contemplation that death is certain. And within that, there is 3 points to reflect on. The first one says contemplation that the Lord of death will definitely come and therefore cannot be avoided, which of course is talking about reflecting on the fact that death is certain, that everyone has to pass through this stage of death, that we can't somehow avoid it, that it's inevitable at some point. And then the second point here is contemplation that our lifetime cannot be extended and constantly diminishes, is reflecting on the fact that in every moment we are moving closer to death. And in the text there, underneath, one of the things it talks about, it says here, well, the time until death passes quickly, life diminishes day and night without a break. And then it says, everything around us teaches impermanence. So everything around us we can use to understand that things are changing all the time. But often when we see impermanence around us, we tend to always reflect on the negative, in that we often feel like impermanence is bad news, because we tend to reflect on impermanence in terms of the good things in our life coming to an end. And so we think of impermanence as somehow bad news. And that we often feel that actually we suffer because things change. But actually, we don't suffer because things change. We suffer because we don't accept the law of change. Because we're trying to hold on to, grasp onto things, trying to make things stable and lasting when they're actually changing. And so it's that attachment or grasping to that that creates a lot of our suffering. And what I'd like to do based on that is read a little bit from this book again here, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, and try to understand impermanence in another way. In fact, the section in the book here is called Impermanence is Good News. So let's have a look why impermanence is good news. So this is on page 30. He says, Buddha was not a pessimist or a doomsayer. He was a realist, while we tend to be escapists. When he stated that all assembled things are impermanent, he did not intend for that to be bad news. It is a simple scientific fact. Depending on your perspective and on your understanding of this fact, it can become a gateway to inspiration and hope, glory and success. For example, to the extent that global warming and poverty are products of insatiable capitalistic conditions, these misfortunes can be reversed. This is thanks to the impermanent nature of assembled phenomena. Instead of depending on supernatural powers such as God's will to reverse such negative trends, a simple understanding of the nature of assembled phenomena is all that is needed. When you understand phenomena, you can manipulate them and thus affect causes and conditions. You might be surprised how much a small step like just saying no to plastic bags would postpone global warming. Recognizing the instability of causes and conditions leads us to understand our own power to transform obstacles and make the impossible possible. This is true in every area of life. If you don't have a Ferrari, you may very well create the conditions to have one. As long as there is a Ferrari, there is the opportunity for you to own one. Likewise, if you want to live longer, you can choose to stop smoking and exercise more. There is reasonable hope. Hopelessness, just like its opposite, blind hope, is the result of a belief in permanence. You can transform not only your physical world, but your emotional world. For example, turning agitation into peace of mind by letting go of ambition, or turning low self-respect into confidence by acting out of kindness and philanthropy. If we all condition ourselves to put our feet in other people's shoes, we will cultivate peace in our homes, with our neighbours, and with other countries. These are all examples of how we can affect assembled phenomena on a mundane level. Siddhartha also found that even the most feared levels of hell and damnation are impermanent, because they too are assembled. Hell does not exist as a permanent state somewhere underground where the damned suffer eternal torture. It is more like a nightmare. A dream in which an elephant tramples you comes about because of a number of conditions. First of all, sleep, and perhaps you have some negative history with elephants. It doesn't matter how long the nightmare lasts, during that time you are in hell. Then, because of the causes and conditions of an alarm clock, or because you have simply finished sleeping, you wake up. The dream is a temporary hell, and it is not unlike our concepts of a real hell. Similarly, if you have hatred toward a person and engage in acts of aggression or revenge, that in itself is an experience of hell. Hatred, political manipulation, and revenge have caused hell on this earth. For example, when a young boy, shorter, thinner, and lighter than the AK-47 he carries, does not have even one day's opportunity to play or celebrate his birthday because he is too busy being a soldier. This is none other than hell. We have these kinds of hells because of causes and conditions. And therefore, we can also exit these hells by using love and compassion as antidotes to anger and hatred, as Buddha prescribed. The concept of impermanence does not foretell Armageddon or the apocalypse, nor is it a punishment for our sins. It is not inherently negative or positive. It is simply part of the process of compounding of things. We usually appreciate only half the cycle of impermanence. We can accept birth but not death, accept gain but not loss, or the end of exams but not the beginning. True liberation comes from appreciating the whole cycle and not grasping onto those things that we find agreeable. By remembering the changeability and impermanence of causes and conditions, both positive and negative, we can use them to our advantage. Wealth, health, peace, and fame are just as temporary as their opposites. And of course, Siddhartha wasn't favoring heaven and heavenly experiences. They are equally impermanent. So I think that can be very helpful, that sort of advice, because we live, of course, in the world of change. Everything is impermanent. We can either accept that change and use it to our advantage, or we can resist it. We can fight against it. I mean, now we tend to be, you know, I like to use the analogy of a person who's in the middle of a fast-flowing river, the river of life. And that when we see some part of life flowing past us that we like, We try and grab hold of it and hold it and don't let it go. So, of course, we can understand that trying to do that takes a lot of energy and in the end it's hopeless. So we're going to produce a lot of unnecessary suffering if we do this. So rather, we should be like someone in the river of life who's in a kayak or canoe with the paddle of mindfulness, who is using the flow of life and navigating through the flow of life to our advantage, to navigate in a good direction in our life instead of fighting against the flow of life. So I think this is, as what he was saying here, is to understand we have the flow and change in life and to use that to our advantage to improve and change. So if we go back now into the death reflection, so we're looking now at the first of the three main points, that death is certain. The first is that death cannot be avoided. It's something that everyone must go through. The second point, which we're just looking at, is that life is constantly diminishing, that we're constantly moving towards death. And the third contemplation here is that we have little time for practice. That, and here is, if we really look at our life, you know, a third of our life is spent sleeping, and then other parts of our day are in other activities. So if we look at the actual amount of time we have available for practice, it's very little. It's not a lot indeed. So these three points are to really come to understand that death is certain, and therefore the each of these three points we can come with a conclusion that because death is certain, then we need to engage in practice. We need to engage in a meaningful life. Because if we don't, then, and we have a caught up in the eight worldly concerns, particularly if we're engaging in any sort of negative, harmful behavior, then we're creating the causes to end up in not a very good future. And of course, even if we don't really believe in future lives, then we don't want to waste this life. So by reflecting here that death is certain, then we come to really appreciate that this precious life is not going to last forever, so let's make use of it while we've got it. And then if we go to the second of the three main points, the contemplation that the time of death is uncertain. Here in this first quote, the last part of it says, "The contemplation of the uncertainty of the time of death is the most important of the three roots." The three roots, of course, are these three main points that we're reflecting on. "This is the very thing that will redirect your mind, so work hard at it." So this point, by reflecting on the fact that the time of death is uncertain, is really going to help us to appreciate that we have this precious human life, but we don't know how long it's going to last. So let's make use of it now while we still have it. Because even though if we simply reflect on the first point that death is certain, then we could still have the idea, okay, I know it's certain, but I've still got a lot of time, you know. I've got a lot of time to do this spiritual stuff. I'll do it later. Whereas if we really reflect on the second point here, that time of death is uncertain, then we're going to understand that we may not have a lot of time, in fact. So let's make use of this precious human life now. So let's have a look at the three points to reflect on here. The first point here, it says the contemplation that the lifespan in this world is uncertain. And here it says Jambudiva. This is a little bit talking about Buddhist cosmology. And so this is sort of our realm of exist within the universe is called Jambudiva. But basically what we're saying here is that the lifespan is not fixed. That, you know, it's not like everyone lives to be 80 or 100 or something. That some people die much earlier and some people much later. So to appreciate here that we do not have a fixed amount of lifespan. And then the second point on the top of page 8 is that it says that the causes of death are very many and the causes of life few. So here it's to really appreciate that there are many things that can cause premature death, you know, accident, illness, injury, war, natural disasters, all sorts of things. There are many causes of premature death, and the causes of life are few. In fact, I think anyone who has studied the body and how the body's functioning, I mean, I think it's quite amazing how it continues to function. So many things need to happen and happen well for it to continue to function. And that if one little thing goes wrong, then the whole thing can collapse. Which actually brings us to the third point, that the body is very fragile. That actually, you know, we tend to feel that our body is very solid and strong, but again, one little thing can happen in our body, one little bacteria or virus or one little thing that goes wrong, and the whole body can collapse. So if we reflect on these three things, that the lifespan is uncertain, there are many causes for premature death, and that actually our body is quite fragile, that is going to really help us appreciate that the time of our death is uncertain. And from that, the conclusion would be that we need to practice now, immediately. We need to make our life meaningful now because we don't know how long we've got. So this is a very important point. And then the third of the three main points here is that at the time of death, nothing helps except religious practice. So what does that mean? And the three points there is that what is not really going to help us at the time of death are the three following things. The first here, it says, friends will not help. Of course, as we're approaching death, then friends can be very helpful, support us and so forth. But here we're talking about the actual moment of death. At the actual moment of death, we have to leave our friends behind. We have to go through that on our own. Likewise, our resources, our possessions cannot help us. We can't take them with us. We have to leave them behind as well. And the third point, our most precious possession we have to leave behind is our body. So we can understand that we can't take any of these things with us through death into the next life. But what will really be helpful at the time of death is how much we've cultivated our mind. That is really what's going to help us through that death process. Therefore, the conclusion of the third reflection is that we need to practice very purely for that reason. So again, the three main points here are that death is certain, and then from that to have the conclusion that we therefore need to make our life meaningful, we need to practice. The second one is that the time of death is uncertain. The conclusion is therefore we must practice now, we must make our life meaningful immediately because we don't know how much time we have. And the third is what is going to help us at the actual time of death is simply how much we have cultivated our mind, how much we've practiced. So therefore, we need to really practice also very purely. So this is what's called the 9-point death meditation, a way of cultivating mindfulness of death. Any questions on that? Any of those points?
Yeah. Are we said, is the idea for this to happen every day or on a schedule? Or am I getting ahead? Sorry.
So, of course, as we're seeing here, these reflections are for the various levels of the practice. So as a beginner, then it's of course good to emphasize the initial ones because they form the basis of the latter ones. But actually a number of times, and I think it's actually coming up soon, maybe a bit later, but basically in a number of places here it says that if we just reflect on these things once or twice, it's not going to really be of huge benefit. Because, I mean, a lot of these points, if we look at them intellectually, we can go, I understand that. Okay, what's next? But what we need to do is to experientially have that sense. And unless we do, our intellectual understanding of this is not really going to drive our behavior. So intellectually, of course, I think we all understand that, you know, death is certain. We don't know when we're going to die, and that we have to leave all these things behind at death. I mean, that's fairly obvious. So, okay, I know that. So why are we doing this, you know? Give me something else to think about. But again, with all of these points, intellectually understanding them and even accepting them is not going to really be of great benefit to us. Because, again, our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit is saying, I'm not going to die today. That's our instinctive habit. Likewise, like the idea of impermanence, you know, we talk about also subtle impermanence, the fact that things are changing moment by moment. I think that's something we all intellectually accept. Science has proven it. We learned it at school. I think none of us have a problem fact of everything's changing moment by moment. True? Is that helping us in our daily life, that intellectual understanding? Not much. Because our behavior is not driven by that. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habit. And our instinctive habit is telling us, this is the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. And we behave in that way. Therefore, of course, when we see things that seem to be stable and we have a pleasant experience, we grab them with attachment. And when we see things that are unpleasant, that seem to be stable, we have aversion to them. So if we really want impermanence to help us in our daily life, then like everything here, we need to reflect and meditate on it and start to taste it experientially. If we can experientially see things as changing moment by moment, actually, it would be very difficult to have attachment and aversion to anything. Because there's nothing to grab, is there? There's just a flow. So what's there to grab? And what's there to push against? Nothing. So, in fact, one of the main antidotes to attachment is reflecting on impermanence. But then again, when people hear that, they go, yeah, I know that things are impermanent, but I'm still attached. Because they haven't internalized it. They haven't they're not experientially seeing things. So, in fact, this brings up a topic I was going to bring later, but now it's a good time to bring it up. There are three stages we can go through in any particular practice. And I like the Tibetan words because they're very short and distinct. The first is go. This is Tibetan. Go means intellectual understanding. So, of course, with any topic, the first is to intellectually understand what's being said. But again, this is not enough. This is not really going to help us so much in our life. Maybe a little bit. I mean, if we really intellectually keep thinking impermanent, yes, it may help us a little bit to reduce some attachment. But again, we tend to just be stimulus reaction machines. So, you know, this idea of constantly impermanent, we'll forget it and then we're just going to grab and push and mess. So we need to internalize this. We need to meditate. We need to start to taste these things, experience these things in meditation. So the second level is it's called nyam in Tibetan, means experience or taste, that we really sit down and we reflect on these with a very calm mind and really start to experientially taste or experience what we, the topic. And this can have then a really quite a strong impact on the mind, and so that after the meditation we can be impacted by that. But, of course, what happens here is that our old habits start to reassert themselves, and then this sort of goes away, finished. So what we need to do is we need to stabilize this so that the impact of our meditation lasts a lot longer, which is the third stage. Which in Tibetan is tok, or realization. So a realization, to realize something, is when we have a very stable, clear experience of it, and that it has a lasting impact after the meditation. To go from here to here, the main key is shamatha practice. Because we can only have a realization of something if we have a very stable, clear mind, if we have the mind of shamatha. So, if we don't put any effort into the shamatha practice, the concentration practice, the best we'll manage is that. We'll maybe have a little bit of a taste of death or impermanence or bodhicitta or something in meditation, and it might have quite a strong impact, and after the meditation we may be affected by it for a little while and then it'll dissipate and it'll be gone, which is of course better than nothing, you know. But if we really want this to have a longer lasting impact in our life, we really need to bring it deeper experience. We need to really put some effort into the shamatha practice, the concentration practice, making our mind more stable, more clear, more focused. Then when we meditate on these topics with a very stable, clear mind, when we do this analytical meditation, which you're doing with Venerable Drolma, and I think you'll be doing this particular meditation later today, then if we can do that analysis and then we come to these conclusions, then we can really, with this very stable, clear mind, we can hold that and it can really penetrate much deeper into our mind and it can really affect our mind much more. And so therefore, this experience in meditation then can carry on into daily life. And then we can start to more instinctively see things in the correct way, more instinctively see things as impermanent, and more instinctively understand that my life is very precious and it's not going to last forever. And then, as it says here, when we looked previously, the benefits of cultivating mindfulness of death, it says, if you create an authentic mindfulness of death, you will see that all toiling for worldly things such as goods, respect and fame is fruitless as winnowing chaff and a source of deception. You're just going to lose interest in these things because you'll see that they're really meaningless. They're not really going to do anything for us. And so then we're really going to want to devote our life to meaningful tasks, meaningful behavior. So this is a little plug for the shamatha practice.
Is there another possible word to use for instinctive? I'm just not sure what that means, other than it becomes something that we do maybe automatically without having to consciously consider, should I do this or that?
Yeah, I mean, it basically just means, yeah, instinctively. Just out. It just means the way we see things normally. So what is now is that the way we see things is often invalid, and it causes a lot of suffering. And so one technique, of course, is to keep reminding ourselves, no, this cup, I know it seems like it's very stable and unchanging, but no, it's not like that because science has proven it. I know that. Okay. And keep reminding ourselves. That's not instinctive. So instinctive means that when we see it, it really seems to be stable. And then we can say, at the first step, we can go, no, that's not right, because I know and science has proven that it's not like that, and remind ourselves. And if we can keep doing that, it can be a bit of help. But what we need to do is to bring that into experience so that when we first look at that cup, then it really does appear to be changing moment by moment, experientially.
How do we get an experience
of that? We have to do that in meditation. We have to do that in meditation. That by doing these meditations, we can really come to realize impermanence in general. And if we can realize it in general, then we're reprogramming our way of seeing things in meditation. That's where it's most effective, which means then in daily life, that will be starting to be reprogrammed to see that in that way. Well, impermanence, of course, we can talk about at two levels. There's what's called coarse impermanence. There's what's called coarse impermanence and subtle impermanence. Coarse impermanence is this cup was at some point in the past created. It's going to be here for a while. Sometime in the future, it'll finish. That's coarse impermanence. And, of course, the example of coarse impermanence we're looking at here is we were born, we're going to die. So that's coarse impermanence. Subtle impermanence is the fact that this is changing in every moment. It's changing in every moment. And so, again, science has proven it. The molecules are all buzzing around, and even what is a molecule? It's if we go down subatomic level, it's sort of zipping in and out of existence. And I mean, there's no solidity there,
yeah.
Is there? There's no stability, no solidity. I mean, according to classical physics, that's mostly space. I mean, there's hard. I mean, even though again experientially, it seems like there's a lot of solidity there, but actually. Scientifically, it's mostly space, and there's no stability there at all. There's a constant flux of things going on at the atomic level. But of course, we don't see that. So therefore, we behave as if this is solid and stable. And that's the problem. That's out of sync with reality, because the reality is this is not solid, this is not stable. That's the reality. I mean, proven by science. It's not some metaphysical belief we have to believe in. It's scientific fact. And so, but again, for that to help us in our daily life, we have to not only intellectually understand that, we have to bring it into experience. We have to experience that within meditation directly, the fact that things are changing moment by moment, because that will have a very strong impact on our habit. And our habit now is to see this as solid and stable. So we're trying to change, because it's a wrong habit, it's a false habit. It's out of sync with reality. So that's what we're trying to do in meditation. Okay, let's move on then. So this is the first part, remember, of developing an aspiration for good future life. is first reflect on death and impermanence. To understand that this precious human life is not going to last forever, so let's make use of it now. The second part of helping to develop that aspiration is here, contemplating, it says in the middle of page 8, contemplating what will occur in your future life, the happiness or suffering of the two types of beings. So that goes back to what we were looking at this morning, this wheel of life. And we talked about the five sections, but in fact, one of those sections up here was sort of divided into two, so we can have six types of existences. So here the two types of beings are often referred to as the fortunate and unfortunate, or the white and black, or the And basically it talks about whether we're in a type of existence that has a lot of suffering or not. And so we have the animal, preta, and narak realm that have a lot of suffering, and within the human, asura, and deva, much less suffering. So these are the two types of beings here that are referred to. And in particular here, in this section, there's a explanation about contemplating those three what's called lower realms, the narak, preta, and animal realm, and to reflect on what type of experiences they have in those three realms. So that's what we see in the bottom of page 8 and a little bit the top of page 9, is to reflect on these three lower realms and the types of existence they have. And of course, we can see here in this narak or hell realm, there's immense suffering of heat and cold and so forth. In the animal realm, also quite a lot of suffering. And in the hungry ghost or preta realm, a lot of suffering in terms of not even being able to get the basic necessities of life. So if we reflect on these types of experiences, and then understand that if we don't like make our life meaningful, if we engage in a lot of harmful behavior in this life, then we're probably going to end up in one of these places, and we really don't want to do that. So if we really reflect on that, then we're going to really have an aspiration to strive for a good future, that we'll want to strive for a good future. So these are the two reflections, death and impermanence, and reflecting on these types of existences that will help stimulate us to have the aspiration to strive for a good future life. Any questions? Yeah.
So samsara isn't a place. Are these places, these realms?
These are places, yes. These are types of existence. So for us, of course, here, being a human, this is we experience a human realm. But of course, in this very same place, an animal experiences the animal realm. Same place, but I mean, they have quite a different experience than us. And also, some of these other beings don't have this same coarse physical body. They may be in the same physical space, but exist. They're experiencing their own realm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are places, but it's really perspective. It's not like some fixed objective place. Mm-hmm. Because as we're going to see when we talk about nature of reality, there is no independent objective world. The world is really a product of our mind. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, the animal realm would be the experience that animals have, which is, of course, in more or less the same physical location as the human realm.
Yeah, a different experience.
Completely. Yeah. Well, very different, at least.
I don't know, this is kind of a big question, but how does this actually work in practice? I mean, for those of us who don't have a teacher, do we, you know, sort of look through here and say, oh, that looks interesting, maybe I'll try this for a while? But if you have a teacher, what happens? You go see the teacher and he says, okay, where were we? We were at B2A1B1. Okay, contemplating the suffering of hell then. That's your assignment.
So, as I said, of course, in our modern society, we have access to a lot of these teachings and audio and so forth, and we can get all these teachings. So even if we don't have a personal teacher, then we can study this and reflect on these points. And so it's good to, of course, to first have a good overview of the whole framework, and then to put emphasis in the foundation practices, you know, the ones we're starting to look at now. Because, you know, we may look later and see some of these other practices and you go, oh, wow, that's nice, I'd like to do that. But then, of course, if we haven't done these basis reflections, particularly the precious human life and death, what often happens is, you know, people look at that and they go, oh, yeah, I know that. That's beginner stuff. That's easy. Give me something more juicy, you know, to meditate on. But then, of course, they go home and then they sort of, you know, get caught up in all these things and they say, oh, I don't have time to meditate and all of this stuff. The reason is because they haven't reflected on precious human life and death. You know, it's like Steve Jobs said, if you really internalize death, you're not going to say, I don't have time to meditate. It's not going to happen. Because a lot of these stuff, I mean, of course, many of us, there are some essential things we have to do. Most of us have to work and earn some money and so forth. But on beyond that, there are many things in our life that we fill up our life with. Because often in our modern society, it's felt, if you're not doing something, you're not being productive. You've got to do something, you know. So we always want to do something.
Even if it's just watching TV.
Yeah. And also, of course, if we're not doing something and we're sitting there, it sort of forces us to look at our mind, which is a mess. And so we don't like that, so we distract ourselves. So we watch a lot of TV and, you know, we go and talk to friends and all of this sort of stuff because we need to occupy our mind because, you know, we don't like what we see when we see the mind. In fact, there was probably some of you have seen recently they did this experiment where they put people in a room and they gave them a little device that would give them electric shocks. And they told them that they had to sit in the room, I think, for 10 to 15 minutes. And there was nothing in the room to stimulate them. And that's all they said. And literally, a huge percentage of them couldn't bear to sit in a room on their own with their thoughts and started shocking themselves. Really, because they needed some stimulation. Really, that was the result of the study. I mean, that's tragic, isn't it? That we can't even sit with our own mind for 10 or 15 minutes. That we have to resort to actually giving ourselves electric shocks.
So going back a little bit to the wheel of life.
Sure.
So you're saying that these are actual places, the realms.
Yeah.
So in the human realm, we can see the animal realm, right?
Right, because our realities overlap enough. Because our physical bodies are very similar, our sensory faculties are similar, therefore we can usually perceive the other.
So how do they know about the preterial and the
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Of course, a Buddhist assertion is that as we purify our mind, we will develop the capability to see these beings. And of course, already some people claim to be able to see Preta beings, Narak beings, and Devas, and so forth. Some people claim to be able to do that. I mean, I have never seen them. But the Buddhist assertion is that as we purify the mind, we can directly see these beings.
Okay. And I wonder if like those realms are like as solid as we see our realm right here. Like I'm touching this paper. When I think of a ghost, I mean, for all I know, they're here.
Exactly.
I don't
exactly. Exactly, because these, I think a lot of these beings, the Preta, Narak, Devas and Suras, don't have this same physical makeup. So they could be, in fact, right here in the same physical space. And what we're going to do is look at later the whole death-rebirth process. And as part of that, there's what's called the intermediate state, the bardo state. And in that phase, there is what's called a bardo being. And as the bardo being, it's said that the bardo being can see these different existences and see human realm and so forth, has that capacity.
I think you almost just answered this. So kind of like we can see the animal realm, they can see into our realm also, the pretas and the hell beings.
Possibly, yes.
That's yeah. Part of what tortures them is they can't be here any longer.
Well, I don't think there's necessarily the fact that these other realms can see the human and animal realm, but yes, certainly I think some of them have that capacity to do that, yes.
I mean, is it helpful? A part of what I'm hearing is like, the entirety of samsara is not absolutely real, but like relatively within all this, it's these different realms seem real to us, including ours and that one. So they kind of are, but not in the bigger picture, not? Or is that...
Well, it depends what you mean by real. So as we're going to look at later in the view of reality, appearances are deceptive. That there appears to be this fixed objective world, but there is no such independent objective world. The world is really a product of our mind. But that doesn't mean the world is just a mere mental fabrication. So to really appreciate that, we have to really sort of understand the Buddhist view of reality. So we're not saying that there is a real independent objective world, but we're also not going to that extreme saying, well, nothing really exists, it's just a mental fabrication. It's the middle, it's in between there. But what that really means, we're going to look at later. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes they say in the text that, you know, if there are three different types of beings in the same space looking in the same place, they may see three completely different things because of their sense faculties and so forth, because there is no fixed, independent, objective reality.
But there's still something there, right? Just what it is.
Yeah. Come here. Okay. So then now let's move on to the second part of the person of small scope. So now the first part was we reflected on death and impermanence. We reflected on what possible conditions we may find ourselves in. And there, as a result, now we have an aspiration that we want to really strive for a good future life and not end up in some suffering existence. So how can we go about achieving that goal of a good future life? And so here there are two topics. The first one we see on page 9 is, well, the outline here is relying on the means for achieving happiness in the next life. There are two topics here. The first is this going for refuge. The second topic that we're going to look at tomorrow morning is the topic of karma. So let's have a look now at the first topic here. What can we rely on to strive for a good future life? And that is training in going for refuge. And it says the excellent door for entering the teaching. So here then, it says that going for refuge is the main door to the Buddha's teaching. If you go for refuge in a way that transcends mere words, you will not be defeated by outer and inner obstacles, for you are relying upon the highest power. Therefore, it is extremely important to uphold the refuges by means of fearing suffering, recalling the good qualities of refuges, and so forth, and to make an effort not to transgress the precepts. So here, what we're talking about is that, you know, if we want to strive for a good future, who or what can we turn to for refuge? You know, who or what can we rely on to enable us to achieve that goal? And so here, we can rely on what's called the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But before we go there, it says the causes for going for refuge. It says, in brief, the causes for your going for refuge are twofold: your fear of miserable realms and the like, and your conviction that the three jewels can protect you from them. So it's the same with everything in our life, that the cause for going for refuge in something is fear of something, and then faith that that thing can protect you from it. For example, we can understand that if we are outside in the sun all day, we might get sunburned. So then we have this understanding, we have this fear that if I stay out all day in the sun, I'm going to get sunburned. So then from that, we can then have faith that maybe putting on a hat and clothes or sunscreen is going to protect us from being sunburned. So likewise here, we can begin by having this fear that, you know, based on my not very good virtuous behavior, I'm going to probably end up in a lot of suffering in the future. And then what can help protect me from that? And so then we can have faith that the three jewels can protect us from that. And so the three jewels are the objects of refuge, which is the next outline. So the objects here of refuge is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It says in that, the identifying the objects which you go for refuge, it says it is right to go for refuge to the Bhagavan Buddha, the true refuge. This citation also applies to the teaching jewel, so that's the Dharma, and the community jewel as well, which is Sangha. So to understand what the three jewels are, often we have an analogy, is that if we are sick, who or what do we turn to for refuge? The doctor. Why do we turn to the doctor for refuge when we're sick? Because we believe that the doctor is qualified and that the doctor can really help us. We have faith in the doctor. So likewise, we can... to overcome any future suffering, we can turn to refuge to the Buddha. We can have faith in the Buddha because the Buddha is qualified, because a Buddha is someone who's overcome all suffering. So they're very qualified in being able to help us. And so here we actually see why the Buddha is worthy to go for refuge. In the next outline, it says there are four reasons. The first is, he has mastered himself and attained the sublime state of fearlessness. So he himself, of course, has overcome suffering. So he knows how to do it. Second, he is in all ways skilled in the means of training disciples. Third, he has great compassion. Fourth, he is pleased not by material things but by offerings of practice. So these four reasons are why the Buddha is a valid source of refuge, particularly the first one, that he himself is qualified because he has overcome suffering himself. And then in the analogy, of course, the actual refuge for our sickness, of course, is the medicine that the doctor prescribes. So likewise, in the three jewels, the thing that is going to be the actual refuge from suffering is the Dharma. And the Dharma can be talked about in two ways or two levels. There is what's called the Dharma of Scripture and the Dharma of Realization. So here, Scripture, of course, is the teachings of the Buddha. The Dharma of Realization is how much we have internalized these teachings. So the thing that is the real actual source of refuge, the actual refuge, of course, is this. To the extent that we have internalized these teachings, to that extent we'll be protected from suffering. So in the analogy, scripture is a little bit like the script for the medicine, or maybe the pills themselves. Realization is when we swallow the medicine. So we can have the best medicine in the world in our hands and hold on to it very tightly, but it's not going to help us overcome our illness. We have to swallow the medicine. So we can have the best teachings in the world and have a lot of intellectual understanding, but it's not going to help. We have to come to internalize, to realize. So this is the real, actual refuge. The Sangha, of course, is the spiritual community that helps us in the spiritual path. And the analogy here is that sometimes, you know, we may need to have an operation to overcome some problem. And then, of course, we need to often recover in the hospital. And so who helps us to recover in the hospital is the nurses. So the Sangha is often related to, in the analogy of the nurses who help us to recover and become healthy again. So the Sangha is the spiritual community who helps support us in our practice. So these are the three jewels. Any questions?
So I understand Dharma. I understand why Dharma is one of the three jewels. I understand why Sangha is putting Buddha at the top. To me, it gets back to our prior discussion about worship versus respect. It's like putting a man being at the top, even though it's his teachings that are what is so important.
Again, this is not so much the order of importance, it's this natural sequence. Mm-hmm. Is that first there was an enlightened being who then taught the Dharma to people who then started to practice it, and then we got a Sangha happening. So it's sort of the chronological order here. It's not sort of in order of importance.
Okay.
So, you know, first we had to have someone who achieved the goal and then taught. And then when he taught, people started following. And when they started following, they became the Sangha. So it's in the sort of chronological order.
Oh, we're still taking refuge in each of those. So are we taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha?
Yes, but again, the actual refuge is this. Uh-huh. This is the real source. But of course, the Buddha is the teacher of this. So to have respect. And of course, the Sangha is who's helping us to implement this. We can worship the Buddha as much as we want. That's not going to help us at all. You know, sitting there saying, Buddha, Buddha, please help me overcome suffering, and doing nothing is not helping. But to have this respect then enables us to also then engage in the teachings more effectively as well.
Since this is the main entry point, though, into the teachings, isn't it fair to say that people that might be attracted to the three jewels may not completely have that understanding? In fact, they may, in fact, be worshiping Buddha, or they may come because of the support they can get from the community. In other words, does it really matter why they came in seeking refuge? Once they're in, don't they grow in their understanding?
Of course, this three jewels and taking refuge we can do at many levels. It comes at many levels because the Dharma comes at many levels. Yes, absolutely.
The problem I always had, the Sangha, growing up in Grove City, Ohio, any number of places where I've been, like, as far as I can see, there is no spiritual community. So the notion of actually being able to take refuge in a thing that, you know, in theory exists but is unknown to me, like, do you have any advice for... I mean, here it's not... It seems like a strange question, but when I go back to the real world, there's going to be this dearth that other people have expressed.
Sure.
Where is the community?
Yeah.
And how do I take refuge as in support from this thing when I can't hardly tell it exists?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is something that I emphasize a lot in the courses I lead, particularly the more introductory levels, the idea of Sangha. Because the reality is that, as you said, you know, we may go home and we may have all these aspirations to change our life and do more meaningful things and to meditate and so forth. But the reality is, of course, we have habits, and so we get swept up in those habits. And unfortunately, many of the people and things around us are sort of driving us in the opposite direction that we're trying to go. And I know from my own personal experience that I did a couple of courses and was very enthusiastic about changing my life and implementing a lot of these ideas. And I went home. For 2 years, nothing happened. Nothing. Because there was no sangha, there was no centers, no nothing. So I wanted to, but then as soon as I got home, I got swept away. And I had no grounding. I had nothing to hold me, nothing to support me. And it was only after 2 years when I changed my environment and I actually found some sangha that I actually started to be able to do something. So I think this is something very important to have sangha. And at minimum level, I think these days you can have virtual sangha at least, even if there's no physical people in your immediate area. So, you know, a lot of the spiritual communities now can, you know, start a little virtual sangha of, you know, doing like chat rooms and so forth. And there's also now even apps and so forth where you can do group meditation in physically remote areas, but you're actually, you know, connected together. So at least that we can manage, even if we're a little bit more remote. But personally, I think if there's no people in your immediate area, I think it's very helpful at least, say, once a week to make effort to go and join a group somewhere, even if it takes some time. Because the reality is, from my experience and many people I talk to as a beginner, to do it on your own is extremely difficult. I mean, if you've got very strong determination, maybe. But many of us, we don't have that as a beginner, and we're just swept away. Even with the best intentions, we really don't manage to sustain anything. So I think the sangha is critical. I mean, really critical. It is so, so helpful. We support them, they support us. So I think at least once a week, if we can manage somehow to get together with some discussion or meditation, would be very, very helpful. And then on top of that, at least once a year, to come to something like this, a group 1 week, 10-day immersion. This as well, I think, is very helpful.
Could I throw one up? Okay, so I forgot the first part, but part of the thing, I mean, even some of the major realizations where it's almost like there's an anti-sangha, like people come out of the woodwork to specifically screw up the realization that I've achieved. One girlfriend in particular is like, you seem like a Hare Krishna now, you're just too blissed out all the time, and went out of her way to make fun of me and whatever. But I mean, again, in my family growing up, right, if it isn't Christian, you know, woo, you're heading for the cuckoo house. So I'm just saying, again, now, so the anti thing, and then again, where there was no real sangha, again, if you're kind of lacking one and running into the other, do you have advice for how to navigate that?
Yeah. One of the pieces of advice, particularly in the Lojong system of practice, but I think in general, is that to not make a big display about your practice. Meaning, you know, often people, you know, get interested in this and then they go home and they sort of say, oh, I'm a Buddhist now, and, you know, they maybe shave their head and wear all this funky Buddhist clothing. I think this is not a good idea. One, you're going to get a lot of anti-people because they think you're some crazy. But also it's a sign that you've just become a spiritual ego now, that the ego has grabbed hold of your spiritual intentions and you're just putting on a different face, and then your practice is not going to go anywhere. So it really, in the Nojong, it talks about really transforming the mind but remaining with the same behavior. So outwardly, I think if you're coming from a very conservative family or community, and you really want to follow a Buddhist path, often it's best not to say that. Just implement the ideas. You don't have to tell them I'm a Buddhist now.
Right on. Yeah. No, I didn't, but...
And if they ask, what are you doing? You're saying, well, I'm trying to develop loving kindness and compassion. I'm trying to be a more kind and considerate person. I mean, how can they argue with that? No? Yeah. You know, I'm trying to develop a stable, clear, calm mind, you know? I'm trying to develop some wisdom and empathy.
That's crazy, though. I mean, they really have come back to me with this, you know, this is just crazy, or you're delusionally blissful but not actually grounded in reality. And that's, again, that's been very difficult to address. But, so, I mean, you know, again, would you say just meet it as best you can and just try not to let them rile your practice?
Yeah, and of course, if we're more stable in the practice, as I mentioned earlier, they're our most holy teacher. Because they can really test where we are, you know. See, actually, you know, it, actually, if everyone's being very kind to us, we can come to this delusional idea that I've overcome anger, you know, that I'm very patient. And then we get someone testing us and we explode. So actually, you know, in small doses, these sorts of people can be very helpful. Of course, if they're in our face all day, every day, it's a bit too much as a beginner. And so maybe we need to sort of step back a little bit. But, you know, every so often them testing us, it's a good measure of, you know, how am I practice going? Am I really developing patience, or is I'm just kidding myself because no one's testing me? Am I really developing loving kindness and compassion, or do these people really irritate me and I wish they'd go away? You know, so these can be a, so, you know, we shouldn't see them as some sort of problems. But again, as a beginner, if we're in an environment where we have this sort of people always there, then it, yes, it would be difficult to do something. So then we maybe need to, you know, step back a bit and then occasionally go into a Sangha community, get some support. But what we shouldn't do is, if we need to get some distance, we shouldn't, we should maybe have some physical distance, but keep them close to our heart. We're not talking about abandoning them. We're not talking about, I don't like them, you know, go away. We're just saying, acknowledging that for me, these people now are really too much heavy negative influence on me that I can't handle. So I'm going to sort of physically step back a little bit so I can work on myself, but keep them close to the heart. And then maybe later, if I develop in the practice, I can engage with them more and not be overwhelmed and maybe have a good impact on them as well.
And maybe you should go to a retreat instead of Thanksgiving with your family. There was something a little earlier that just didn't pass my melting, scratching test.
Okay.
But coming back with what we said, it's contemplating the suffering of hell denizens.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, you know, the spiritual path, why I'm here, is to bring out the love and to not bring out the fear. And that smacks so much of hell and brimstone and fear this and have faith, have blind faith.
No.
That's really an obstacle for me.
Yeah, so no blind faith. Blind faith doesn't help. So here we are using reasoning. We are reflecting on that these are possible future existences, and that if I continue to engage in harmful behavior, I'm likely to end up in one of those places. I don't want to end up in one of those places, so let's do something about it. That's what we're talking about. So fear here is not, it's more about understanding the consequences of our actions and not wanting to have that result. That's what we're talking about. And then based on that logical reflection, then we can really, through using that reasoning, then have faith based on reasoning that in fact Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, particularly the Dharma, the teachings of Buddha, can help me so that I don't end up in that future type of existence. So yes, blind faith we don't want. And again, all of these reflections are really based on, you know, the idea of cause and effect. just understanding that, you know, if we really continue to engage in this harmful behavior, as we're going to see with this principle of karma tomorrow, then what are the consequences of that? The consequences will be something like this. We don't want that in the future. What can we do to avoid that? We can really go for refuge to the Dharma.
How do we accept that those are possible future states of existence without blind faith?
Yeah. So if, of course, we don't have any belief in rebirth, we can also use this to apply to our own life now, understanding that if we really engage in a lot of harmful behavior now, we're probably going to have a lot of enemies and a lot of negative consequences in the future of this life. And we're probably going to end up with some very hell-like experiences, people hating us, and maybe also we're going to find that people stealing from us, and we're going to end up losing a lot of things and having a preta-like experience and so forth. So we can also use this in terms of understanding in this future of this life. So I think we can use it in this way as well.
So would you say, you know, getting back to our study questions today, whatever, is it more important for you to be part of a sangha than it is to have a teacher? I mean, could you get by being a member of a sangha and without having a teacher?
So, of course, remember, everyone and everything can be our teacher. And generally, within a sangha, you will have people who are probably, some of them at least, more experienced than you, and so that they can, at a fairly basic level at least, give you some advice and guidance because they have a little bit more experience than you. So some of the more senior members of a sangha could act as a little bit of a personal teacher for you as well. So I think that, of course, where there is a qualified teacher, there generally always is some sort of sangha as well. So I think that certainly the sangha, I mean, if you have a qualified teacher but no sangha, I think that's going to be difficult. Well, in fact, wherever there's a qualified teacher, there will be a sangha. But if you just get personal advice from a teacher and then you go back home and there's no sangha and you try to implement their instructions, I think you're going to find it very difficult. I think the sangha is critical. Of course, on top of that, if you do have a personal teacher, then you can get very, very precise instructions about what practices to do. But without sangha, I think even if you get the best instructions in the world as a beginner, I think you're going to find it difficult to implement unless you're quite self-determined, you know, you have a lot of, you're not easily influenced by others. So I think sangha in general is my experience, and many people I talk to, is very important as a beginner.
And does it matter what the group size is?
The main point with sangha, of course, the sangha needs to be a group of people who are trying to do something similar. You know, if you're trying to follow this system and the sangha is doing from some other tradition that has completely different perspective, this is going to be a little bit awkward, difficult. And then I wanted to mention something else there, but it slipped my mind. One of the key elements with sangha that I've seen and really is super important is harmony. The number one thing, harmony. Without harmony, then the sangha is just a problem. And this is a sign often that when we have a sangha that lasts longer, you find there's a lot of harmony within the sangha. And there's a lot of support there, supporting each other. Okay, we've run out of time there, so let's stop there. There's some more things I want to mention a little bit about refuge, but we'll leave that till tomorrow morning. So for tomorrow then, we're going to continue on in this refuge presentation, and then after this, on page 12, there is the presentation on karma. So we're going to go through that presentation tomorrow morning. So that's also to do with someone who is striving for a good future. To reflect on the karma, the law of cause and effect in terms of our behaviour. Following that, then we're going to start to look at the person of medium capacity, which is someone who is now striving not just for a good future, but to strive to be liberated from samsara altogether. So that starts on page 15. So, of course, same thing here. We first need to develop the aspiration for liberation. So to do that, we need to reflect on the first two noble truths, the truth of suffering or dukkha and the cause of suffering or dukkha. And so that will lead us into page 15, 16, and we'll probably get down to somewhere about page 17 by the end of tomorrow. So that's the program for tomorrow. So if you want to prepare a little bit, you can skim through some of those points up to page 17. And then this evening, with Venerable Dromo, you'll be, I think, in the next session doing a little bit more work about preparing the body and mind for meditation and also a little bit of a reflection on the precious human life. And then this evening, two parts to the meditation. The first is a little bit this mindfulness of death, then leading into contemplation of refuge into Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay, so that's for this evening. So have a short break, and I'll see you tomorrow, and then you'll be doing the meditation very soon.